It is now time for our featured segment. It is called Mic Check. As I said at the beginning of this program this morning, it is Saturday, October 1st. The month of October is recognized as Breast Cancer Awareness Month. We have just transitioned from September, which was Prostate Cancer Awareness Month. And next month, we will be talking testicular cancer here on Groovin' Radio. Groovin' Radio Awareness Campaign for breast cancer starts now. Get screened for prevention and early detection. It is said that early detection saves life. Our featured guest has arrived, Anthony. Please do the honors and introduce our guests.
Yes, Rascam, our special guest on Mic Check this morning. We're talking to Dr. Camelia Lawrence. And she's a board-certified surgeon specializing in benign and malignant breast disease. And she currently serves as the director of breast surgery for the Hospital of Central Connecticut and Mid-State Medical Center, tasked with the responsibility of further developing their breast program. She's also the vice president for Fairfield County Medical Association. And she has received numerous awards, including the Dr. Kenneth Woodward Memorial Award, Rush Henrietta Rotary Club's Humanitarian Award, and the Carrie Ann Smith Award. And in 2005, she was chosen by the Urban League of Southern Connecticut to receive the Woman of Power Award. And she was awarded the 2017 Doctor of Distinction Award for Fairfield County, and most recently she received the 100 Women of Color Award, and this was in Hartford, Connecticut. And in 2020 she was honored with the Denise Denny Taft Empowerment Award that recognizes and celebrates exceptional champions of gender equity and women's advancement. And Dr. Lawrence was born in our second city in Montego Bay, St. James, Montego Bay to exact. So there you have it, our special guest this morning, Dr. Lawrence, right here on Groovin' Radio.
She's also a motivational speaker and a community advocate. I welcome Dr. Camelia Lawrence to Groovin' Radio. Good morning, Dr. Lawrence. How are you?
Good morning, gentlemen. I am well. Thank you for that fine introduction.
You're so welcome. You know, we're in the month of October. The last time we had you here on Groovin' Radio was last year, just around this time, as we kick off our breast cancer awareness presentations. You know, it is a disease that affects our community. The black and brown community had a very high number. And we always want to start with asking the question, why so? Why so, Dr. Lawrence, that breast cancer attacks our community the way it does? That's where we start this morning.
Yeah. So, you know, breast cancer, there is disparity in both screening and diagnosis of the disease among black and brown communities. Mm-hmm. And it's not necessarily that our communities are impacted more frequently. Mm-hmm. It's just that they survival from the disease. Women of color are twice as likely to die of breast cancer once diagnosed. It's a very complex issue. There are a multitude of factors. One has to do with access. Two, it has to do with being able to get the accurate care that is needed. The management of a breast cancer patient extends beyond just surgery. Mm-hmm. There's also radiation and chemotherapy. And in order for you to optimize your survival, you have to receive all the arms of treatments that are needed. Mm-hmm. The other piece of it has to do with biology does play a role. We know that black women in particular are more likely to develop a type of breast cancer that's called triple negative breast cancer, mm-hmm. which confers a more aggressive tumor biology, meaning that they're more likely to have metastatic disease or local recurrence. But a big issue within our community is late stage of diagnosis. You know, breast cancer when caught early is a very manageable, very treatable disease. But if you present at very late stage, your treatment options are limited mm-hmm. and the survival rates are significantly less. Mm-hmm.
Inflammatory breast cancer. Talk to our community about that, please, Dr. Lawrence.
Inflammatory breast cancer, it's a type of breast cancer. Fortunately, it is not very, very common. Mm-hmm. The most common type of breast cancer that we deal with is called invasive ductal carcinoma. Mm-hmm. But inflammatory breast cancer is a very aggressive type of breast cancer. It typically presents with sometimes could be a mass within the breast, but also redness and thickening of the breast. Mm-hmm. The symptoms usually evolve very quickly. You know, I've had patients come in and said this started maybe about 6 weeks ago or 2 months ago. They've noticed this rapid change within the breast. Because of the aggressiveness of the disease, it's usually treated up front with chemotherapy and then followed by surgery and radiation.
Mm-hmm. You know, go ahead.
I was going to say the message here that I would really like to drive home is that any woman that notice any changes within your breast, mm-hmm. it is very, very important for you to seek medical attention right away. I often tell my patients, I'd rather you come in and it's a nothing than for you to delay the diagnosis if there's something going on.
Mm-hmm. You know, at this time of the year, we will see all these pink ribbons going up. It's an indication mm-hmm. that we're at that time and we should be aware, and our community should be aware of what's going on. You talk about access to health care, and at mm-hmm. times it is challenging for some of us, but mm-hmm. that shouldn't deter anyone, any mm-hmm. woman, any man who feels anything from going to the doctor, right?
Correct, because, you know, fortunately, within most states within this country, there are programs that are designed to help with screening for breast cancer, which means that there are often local clinics affiliated with major institutions where a woman can go and have a mammogram done or present if they have a complaint about the breast. But I think it's also, it's empowerment, mm-hmm. it's knowledge. Is really impressing upon women within our community regarding the importance of screening, early detection, and diagnosis. You know, one of the comments that I often receive sometimes when I'm out in a community, because my focus is primarily in grassroots empowerment, mm-hmm. is that, oh, it doesn't run in my family. You know, no one in my family has ever had breast cancer. Mm-hmm. Well, the overwhelming majority of women who develop this disease have no family history of breast cancer, more than 80%. So what that means is that you can be the first in your family to develop this disease. We are all susceptible to this disease. None of us are immune from this disease.
Mm-hmm. You know, we hear that all the time. And I was waiting to go there in terms of the family history, where people like to say, Anthony, that it's not in my family. Heart disease is not in my family. Prostate cancer is not in my family. So I'm not concerned. But as things change and times change, Doc, you just said it. You can be the first, huh? You can be the first to come down with this. Anthony, you have a question for the doctor?
Yes. You talk about the family history, but in terms of even ethnicity, does that play a major role? Are we more susceptible because we're the black community?
No, we're not. In fact, the majority of breast cancer that we see falls under the category which is considered as sporadic breast cancer, which means we don't know what caused it. Mm-hmm. About 10% can be due to hereditary factors. And the communities that are actually predisposed because of the BRCA1 and 2 mutations, actually the Ashkenazi Jewish community are at a higher risk because of the higher incidence of this genetic mutation. So as a community, as a black community, we're not necessarily at a higher risk of developing the disease.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You just mentioned BRCA genes. You just mentioned BRCA, and there's also HER2. Can you talk about the difference between these two, HER2 and BRCA?
So they're two distinct entities. So BRCA refers to a type of mutation. Mm-hmm. So you have BRCA1, you have BRCA2, and there are other mutations that are known, which is a change in the DNA makeup of that individual mm-hmm. that increases her chance for breast as well as ovarian cancer. Mm-hmm. The families that have this genetic mutation, the BRCA1 or 2 mutation, are at a substantially higher risk for breast cancer. For example, those with the BRCA1, the lifetime risk approaches about 85%. So I often tell my patient, it's not a matter of will I get breast cancer? It's sort of when will I develop this breast cancer? Mm-hmm. And because we have the technology that allows us to test for these genetic mutations, there are risk-reducing steps that can be taken to decrease your chances of ever developing breast cancer. Mm-hmm. And that's why it's so important to talk to your family, because family history is king. And you need to know that whether this is a mutation that runs in your family, because there are proactive things that you can do to prevent yourself from developing this disease. HER2 is a tumor protein. Whenever a woman has breast cancer, there are three protein markers that are looked at that helps to guide treatment. We've moved away from one size fits all, and we really focus now on what we consider as precision medicine. Mm-hmm. So the three proteins that we look at are the estrogen, progesterone, and the HER2. And though that information helps to guide the medical oncologist as to what drugs would best treat that woman's particular cancer. So that's separate from the genetic piece of it, which is the BRCA1, 2, and the other mutations that we've since identified. Mm.
Ladies and gentlemen, you are listening to Grooving Radio. You're listening to the voice of a breast surgeon and breast cancer director, motivational speaker, and community advocate, Dr. Camelia Lawrence. It is Grooving Radio Awareness Breast Cancer Awareness Campaign this Saturday morning, and we are talking directly to our community. And yes, we're reaching outside the community also, ladies and gentlemen. October is observed and recognized as Breast Cancer Awareness Month. Pay attention to your bodies, ladies and gentlemen, too, because oftentimes, Doc, men feel that they don't get breast cancer. We fall in that category too, huh?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. I'm so glad you mentioned that, because while breast cancer is primarily a disease of women, men do get breast cancer. Mm-hmm. And so it's very important for us to acknowledge that as well. Majority of time when men do develop breast cancer, it's actually associated with the BRCA2 mutation. Mm-hmm. But if a man has a breast cancer, we all get from mom and dad. 50% from mom, 50% from dad. Mm-hmm. So if you do dad who's had cancer, means that you're also at risk for a breast cancer as well. So men do get breast cancer. In the United States, we see about 1-2% of men are impacted. So about 2,000-3,000 cases annually. So it's less rare among men than women, but they do get breast cancer.
It is said, ladies and gentlemen, that early detection, it saves life. It's better when you're detected early. Now, I was watching a program recently, Cancer in America. And in the report, it says that cancer deaths are steadily falling. Is that because folks are now taking heed and listening to the message, Doc? If it is so, is it because we're, you know, understanding more about these diseases?
I think it's a combination of an increased depth of knowledge as well as advancement in treatment. Technology has brought us a long way. Mm-hmm. We now offer more tailored treatment, specifically targeted particular to particular tumor as well as the biology of the tumor. Mm-hmm. So we're getting better at diagnosis. We're getting better at treatment. We're getting better at educating and empowering the public as well. Mm.
Here's a question from our live stream. What caused breast cancer? Is there a specific cause?
That's a million-dollar question. Mm. We don't know.
We don't know.
The majority of women who get breast cancer, we don't know what caused it, mm-hmm. and which is why it's so important for us to understand that any one of us can be impacted because we don't know what caused it. Mm. I mean, there are guesses or, you know, or theories regarding factors that increases your risk for cancer, not just breast, but all cancer. Mm-hmm. One has to do with diet and exercise. We know that obesity increases one's risk of malignancy. Mm-hmm. Any sort of tobacco use increases your risk of malignancy. So lifestyle does play a role. Mm-hmm. As well as the fact that there may be some environmental changes, our foods, our diet, who knows? There's no causative agent that has been identified as directly relating to breast cancer. So it's a combination of factors, I suspect.
And now, recently, scientists are now saying that there is now a link between alcohol, drinking alcohol, and cancer. And it doesn't have to mean that you are a alcoholic or whatever, mm-hmm. but it's now said by scientists that there is a link between alcohol and breast cancer. So ladies, gentlemen, we want you to be aware. We want you to get tested, get screened. Because if you get screened today and there's a lump, it don't mean that the lump is cancerous. And sure. it's very productive that you take these messages serious. Because again, like I said, for prostate cancer, we suffer as black men more than almost any other ethnic group. For breast cancer, black and brown, we suffer. And at times it is because we feel these pains, doc, and we don't take heed. So now, yeah. When should a woman get screened and tested for breast cancer? When? At what stage?
Yeah, so the average age that is endorsed for screening is the beginning of age 40. Mm-hmm. However, if you have a family history of breast cancer, that age may be even sooner. Mm-hmm. So I often say by age 30, the latest, every woman should have had a family risk assessment to see when, if they meet criteria to be screened earlier. For example, if you have a family history and you yourself tested positive for the BRCA1 or 2 mutation, the recommendation is that you initiate screening at age 25. But for the average risk woman, the recommended age to begin screening mammography is age 40.
Mm-hmm. You know, recently I asked this question to my listening audience, and I'm going to ask it this morning again. Is there anyone in the audience who have ever gone to the doctor and the doctor said, you have cancer? What was that like for you? Because I ask that question because folks think that it's a death sentence. Mm-hmm. Can you share with our audience this morning, Dr. Camelia Lawrence, that mm-hmm. hearing the words that you have cancer is not a death sentence?
It is not, especially as it pertains to breast cancer. We've made so much progress in diagnosis and treatment of the disease. Mm-hmm. You know, like we think about cancer in terms of stages. For example, stage 0 breast cancer, which is called ductal carcinoma in situ. That's the earliest stage of breast cancer. And the 5-year survival rate for women diagnosed with DCIS approaches 99%. So it's a very treatable disease. So it's definitely not a death sentence. And when you look at the data, there are more than 2 million breast cancer survivors within our country alone. So what that tells you that people are being diagnosed with the disease and they're going on to have treatment and to be able to return to their normal lives. We have a responsibility to make sure that we are following the screening guidelines, the recommendations. If we notice a change within our breast, we need to have it evaluated. Mm-hmm. If you feel as if you were being dismissed over something that is new, it's okay to get a second opinion. Mm-hmm. You need to be an advocate for yourself mm-hmm. Also.
You know, we're being that advocate this morning for cancer sufferers, for people who are at risk for cancer. What type of breast cancer are more severe? And some will ask, are they incurable? Are there types of cancers that are more severe? I think we covered triple negative, inflammatory, and metastatic yeah. this morning. Which one is more severe?
It depends on what stage. You know, when we think of stage 4 disease, that's metastatic breast cancer. That is disease that has started in the breast, it's made its way to the lymph node, and is now in other organs within the body. Mm-hmm. That is somebody that's not curable. However, there are several advances in terms of the drugs and the pharmaceutical agents that are available to treat stage 4 breast cancer. So I have patients, for example, within my practice that I'm aware of that are more than 10 years out and have had stage 4 breast cancer. So there are treatments available. But the key and the cornerstone of our message today is that we prefer not to meet you when you're stage 4. Ideally, we'd like to find you at stage 0 or stage 1 at the earliest possible stages when the disease is treatable mm-hmm. and you can have an excellent outcome.
Well, Anthony, go ahead.
Another question I have, Doc, especially for folks who may have some sort of family history. They're mm-hmm. opting to do radical surgery to remove their breasts even before mm-hmm. they are diagnosed or they reach any particular stage. Is this recommended, or what's your thoughts on this?
So yeah, the current guidelines that we follow for women who have the BRCA mutation recommends consideration of bilateral risk-reducing mastectomies. And the whole idea is that you're removing the breast tissue to prevent this woman from developing breast cancer. And we've come a long way in terms of her options for reconstruction or without reconstruction. You know, I can say there are women who I see in my practice, they come in and they know they have a family history. Many are done with childbearing, and they say, Dr. Lawrence, I just want to have the breast removed. I do not want to be reconstructed. I'm fine with it. My husband is fine with it. I just don't want to ever have to deal with breast cancer, so I just want a mastectomy. And then there are women who come in, and they want to undergo the risk-reducing mastectomy, and they also want to have reconstruction at the time, at the same time. So we do have plastic surgeons who help with that reconstructive piece. And in terms of a surgical component of it, we now do what's called nipple sparing mastectomy. It is very possible in some women, depending on the size of the breast, that you're able to go in and sort of scoop out all the breast tissue and reconstruct the breast without everyone being able to notice that this woman has had a mastectomy unless she chooses to divulge that information. Mm-hmm. So the surgical technique has gotten much better, but strongly recommended that if you are a carrier of the BRCA1 mutation, it is very acceptable to consider reducing your risk by having that risk-reducing mastectomy.
Mm-hmm. Based on your experience, Dr. Camelia Lawrence, can treatment on clinical trials, do you think treatment in clinical trials can help to manage severe and or incurable breast cancer?
Oh, absolutely. And that's an area where there's a deficiency within our community, right? We don't really participate in clinical trials.
Mm-hmm.
So information that's gleaned, it's very difficult to make it applicable to our communities if we don't participate in these clinical trials.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of misconception about clinical trial that it's experimental drug on one arm versus the other. The majority of clinical trials, they offer you the basic standard of treatment for care.
Mm-hmm.
The clinical trial piece of it is usually a new or emerging drug that is unclear as to whether it or not. So you either get randomized to get in that new drug, mm-hmm. or not get in that drug. But in terms of treating your underlying disease, it would be unethical to put you in an arm where you get no treatment for your cancer and allow it to metastasize.
Mm-hmm.
Thankfully, come way past that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Before we take the break, Dr. Lawrence, why do you think that our community shy away from clinical trials? Why?
Mistrust.
Mm.
And perhaps in many ways, based on the history of science and clinical trial within this country,
mm-hmm.
We are in the process of rebuilding trust within our communities of color. There are multiple examples of where communities of color, black communities, have been impacted negatively through experiments that they didn't even know they were participating in.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So there's this underlying fear that, you know, are they, you know, experimenting on me, or am I getting the treatment that I need to get? So folks tend to shy away once they hear the word clinical trial.
Mm. You know, this conversation we're having this morning, it is a very difficult conversation for many of us to have. I had to build up the courage over the years to have conversations like this. I've had family members who have suffered from breast cancer.
Mm-hmm.
I've had family members who had leukemia, prostate cancer, and mm-hmm. it touches home. And that is why I care the way I care about this community, friends mm-hmm. and families and foes. It is important that you know your health status, because you don't want to go to the doctor when you're stage four. Mm-hmm. You don't want to go to the doctor then. You want to catch it early. Early detections save lives. And as you said earlier, Doc, having these conversations and ladies going out and getting screened at an early age, and the age is getting lower and lower as we speak, ladies and gentlemen, because we're not living in the clean times like we were living way back then. There's so much that is contributing to our ill health today. And that is why you have to get screened early. Men, get screened for prostate cancer early. Testicular cancer. Ladies and men, get screened for breast cancer. October is the month that is dubbed Breast Cancer Awareness Month. Anything else you have, Anthony, before we take the break in 30 seconds?
Well, I think the doc is actually doing a very good job. I'm thinking about the age or even COVID.
When we come back, yes, COVID. When we come back, we ask the first question we'll start off is, what can a breast cancer patient do to prevent themselves from COVID? You're listening to Groovin' Radio. We're going to take a quick 3-minute break. And when we come back, breast surgeon Dr. Camelia Lawrence will wrap our conversation on breast cancer this Saturday morning. Stay where you are. And as we return, ladies and gentlemen, for the final 26 minutes of our Groovin' Radio's presentation this Saturday morning, I welcome you back to Mic Check. Mic Check this morning is Groovin' Radio Breast Cancer Awareness Campaign. It started this morning right here, and our featured guest this morning is breast surgeon Dr. Camelia Lawrence. She's also a motivational speaker. She is a community advocate, ladies and gentlemen, and she has won numerous awards over the years for the work that she has done and continue to do in this community. Welcome back, Dr. Lawrence.
Thank you.
Before we took the break, Anthony brought us brought up something very important. We're living in COVID-19 times, mm-hmm. and as we wean our way out, recently I heard the World Health Organization mention that we're at the end of this pandemic. It's been 2.5 years and counting. Yeah, it's been 2.5 years and counting, and it was great to see you at JA60. I saw you for the first time, even though we have chatted over the years, but it was so good to see you. We came out and we gathered and we had a good night. That is because, yes, COVID is going, huh?
Exactly.
Yes.
To see you as well as to reconnect, you know.
Yes.
I think our lives have been upended and done it, but the most impact has been our ability to sort of get together and to meet our loved ones and friends. And so it was great to reconnect with you and others recently.
Indeed.
But, you know, as it pertains to breast cancer, what we've noticed with what COVID did essentially was forced us to redeploy our resources. Mm-hmm. So I know that many centers, my organization included, screening mammography in some places were stopped. We were handling those that were diagnosed with breast cancer, but in terms of routine screening, mm-hmm. we had to redeploy our resources to push back at the challenges of the COVID-19 pandemic and those who were severely ill from the virus. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we're very much almost back to normal, I would say, in terms of availability of screening. Mm-hmm. But if you recall, there were additional precautions that needed to be taken into consideration to continue screening, such as the amount of volume of patients that you had, the time that you needed to clean spaces, mm-hmm. the masking, the equipment to sterilize so that you can get the next patients in. Mm-hmm. So what we saw was many women skipped their mammography during the COVID-19 pandemic. Mm-hmm. The majority was out of fear, right? Fear of going to a public facility and mm-hmm. being screened and in the process, you know, picking up the virus. Mm-hmm. Well, thank God for the vaccine. We know that, you know, even if you were to get the COVID-19 with the vaccine on board, folks aren't dying of the virus anymore. Mm-hmm. So we are actually encouraging women to return to their normal screening. If you've skipped a year or two, really need to go in and have your screening mammogram done.
Talking about being scared of going into the hospitals during COVID-19, I remember I had a colonoscopy schedule, and this was in 2020, just around June, and people were just dying like crazy from COVID-19, and I said to my doctor, I'm not coming. And I did not go. I didn't.
Yeah, no. My chances to go and cancer.
Later on that year, he called me and he said, this is the safest time to do it. There's nobody here. So I went and I got it done in October of 2020. Yeah. But I was scared. I really, really was scared. But as we wrap this morning's conversation, Doc, on breast cancer, you know, what should a breast cancer patient do? Is there anything that they can do to protect themselves from COVID-19? Because we're still having COVID-19, the BA2.75. Yeah. What can a patient with cancer do to protect themselves?
I think, you know, it's good to have a conversation with your doctor, which is usually the treating physician is a medical oncologist doing chemotherapy, because that's usually the phase where patients are immunosuppressed and they're more susceptible. Mm-hmm. The timing, they should be vaccinated. The timing of the vaccination should be discussed with their medical team. But I see the precautions that have been put out by the CDC should be adhered to. If you have breast cancer and you're currently undergoing treatment, you probably should still be wearing your mask so that you can protect yourself and just be very conscious of your environment. A large gathering and crowds especially is probably not the best place for you.
I know we spoke about race and different ethnic groups, but as a Jamaican, many of us don't have a family history. Many of us don't know what our grandparents or our great-grandparents, or sometimes we don't even know what our mother and father, if they have passed away, they passed away from. What would you recommend for our listeners this morning? If there's no evidence of any kind of disease, we're talking breast cancer this morning in the family, how concerned should they be and what should they do?
If there's no family history, then you follow the standard guidelines, which is being screened starting at age 40. If there's a concern that there's a potential family history, multiple family members have died of this disease, or sometimes patients will come in and say, I think it's ovarian, but it may be uterine. There are many places that will give you the option of a consultation with a genetic counselor. And if you are unable to clearly delineate your family history, such as in those who are adopted and don't know their family history, and you're interested in genetic testing, they'll be able to offer that option to you to see if there's an identifiable mutation that increases your particular risk for breast cancer.
The fact that we have identified some of the reasons why our community, the black and brown community, is affected at a higher rate. We spoke about the fact that sometimes it's lack of insurance, you know, being scared about going to the doctor, being worried about what have happened in the past in terms of how they have treated us. In today's age and time, what would be your message to the community about breast cancer and other cancer? What would be your message?
I think we're living in an era of communication and information. We all have access to the internet, which has its upsides and its downsides. But if you're at all concerned, you should, the onus is on that patient to put yourself in an environment where you can get the screening and the care that you need. And sometimes it may not be an easy task, but you are the best advocate for yourself. Also be aware of who are the community leaders in your respective spaces, because sometimes you may not be able to get something done, but you may be able to call somebody, or somebody may have a connection that may be able to help you plug into a pipeline that will allow you to get the care that you need. But you have to advocate for yourself. You have to take some personal responsibility. You have to also take in consideration things that you can do, modifiable risks, things that you can do to reduce your risk of cancer in general, not just breast cancer. Diet and exercise plays an important role. So prioritizing yourself, self-care, having those honest conversations with yourself in terms of things that you can do that are risk-reducing.
From all the different kinds of breast cancers that are out there, and some of what we spoke about this morning, like triple negative and inflammatory and metastatic, from all the different type of breast cancers that are out there, what is the most common breast cancer that you see in your practice?
The most common breast cancer is usually invasive ductal carcinoma. The mm-hmm. second most common is invasive lobular carcinoma. Mm-hmm. And the most common ways in which breast cancer presents itself is usually on mammography. A woman come in for a screening and an abnormality is found. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it may be in mass. Sometimes it can be an air-based spirometry. Breast cancer may even present as microcalcifications in mammography. So I have patients who come in and sometimes, well, I examined my breast and I didn't feel anything. Well, breast cancer doesn't always present as a lump. It can present as skin thickening or any sort of skin change. It can present as nipple discharge, or it can present as microcalcifications, which even myself as a breast surgeon and a clinician, I'm not going to appreciate that on a clinical exam, which is why mammography is so crucial, because until you get that x-ray picture of the breast, that is the way in which you'll be able to identify that cluster of microcalcification that then signals to the radiologist that a biopsy is needed of this error in order to clinch a diagnosis. So that's another piece of wisdom I'd like to depart to women in our audience today, is that you don't always feel or see the changes within the breast that represent a cancer, which is another reason why mammography is so important. And the other piece is that if you a biopsy is suggested, don't delay it.
Mm-hmm.
Get it done. You know, it's earlier for you. It's better for you to know earlier than later. I have patients that, oh, I'll come back next week, and then you don't see them for 6 months, and you're tracking them down to try to get them to have a biopsy. But get the biopsy done.
Mm-hmm.
The other piece of information I like to disseminate this morning is women who have dense breasts. About 40% of women have dense breasts. And what dense breast means is that things can hide within the breast tissue and are not easily appreciated on mammography. So if you do have dense breasts, you should ask your clinician, would I benefit from an ultrasound in addition to mammography? Not as a replacement, but in addition to mammography.
Mm-hmm.
Because breast cancer shows up as white.
Mm-hmm.
Women with dense breasts have a very white background.
Mm-hmm.
So the cancer can easily blend in with that whiteness. So the ultrasound represents an additional modality for you to look through the breast tissue to make sure there aren't any underlying abnormalities that warrants further workup.
Mm. Final piece of this presentation this morning, the fact that we have now identified that hearing the word that you have cancer is not a death sentence, and especially cancers like breast cancer and mm-hmm. prostate cancer. The survival rate. What is the survival mm-hmm. rate like these days? Final question.
It's very good for breast cancer. The survival rate is based in stages. So as I mentioned before, mm-hmm. 5 year, let's say for DCIS, is about 99%.
Mm-hmm.
For stage three breast cancer, I think it's about 85%.
Mm-hmm.
In contrast, stage four, the 5 year mm-hmm. survival rate for stage four, that's metastatic breast cancer, that's down to 24%.
Mm-hmm.
So look at the huge precipitous drop from someone early stage breast cancer, stage zero, 95% to 99%, to a 24% survival.
Mm-hmm.
So again, just want to reiterate the importance of early detection, screening mammography, because it does save life and it has a huge impact in terms of your survival.
Mm. Dr. Camelia Lawrence, I thank you so very much for joining us this morning and sharing the information. You are the expert, madam. You are indeed a great breast surgeon. I understand that you're one of the finest in the state of Connecticut. And I mean, you have done it. You have done it. And I thank you again. As a motivational speaker and as a community advocate, it is very important that we share these messaging. And this is why I kicked off the month of October with a breast cancer awareness campaign. And I'm happy that you were able to join us this morning. Your closing remarks, Doc, as we wrap. Closing remarks.
Well, thank you so much for having me again on this platform. And a big shout out to you, RescClam. Thank you for continuing to lift me up and to support me on this journey. I really appreciate you.
You are so welcome. We appreciate you even more. As a matter of fact, we appreciate, love you even more. What, how about that? Dr. Camelia Lawrence, have a blessed day. And I hope your golf game get better, all right? We'll talk soon.
Don't go there.
We will talk soon. Inside joke, Doc. Inside joke.
Yes.
Take care. Have a blessed day. One love.
Yes. Bye-bye.
Take care. That was Dr. Camelia Lawrence, ladies and gentlemen. She is indeed a very good breast surgeon. She is a regional breast cancer center director, a motivational speaker, and a community advocate. I hope she was of some great use to the community this morning. We have come to the end of Mic Check. Anthony Turner had to run. He has some kind of engagement that he had to attend to. We have about 13 more minutes before we wrap up the presentation, which gives me a little bit of time this morning to welcome you once again, my Saturday morning listeners, to our Grooving Radio Charity and Nonprofit Corner. And this is where we start off with St. Andrew Technical High School Alumni Association. They're getting ready for their 16th annual fundraising ball, and this one takes place next week, Saturday, October 8th, inside the Eastwood Manor. Please call Melbourne, because we're honoring diligence and service. Call Melbourne at 516-661-4544 for your tickets. I understand that the tickets are going fast, ladies and gentlemen, so we want you to be a part of this. We are also talking about the girls from Alpha. They're having their grand event also inside the Eastwood Manor. And this one takes place on October 15th. I'm hoping to catch up with someone from Alpha come next week. You can call Miss Beverly Dixon at 917-747-9804. That is Beverly Dixon at 917-747-9804. That is to support the Alpha girls. Yes, they're having their grand celebration. Then we talk about Moran Bay High School. They're getting ready for their 36th anniversary dinner dance black tie affair at the same venue, Eastchester Eastwood Manor on Eastchester Road. This one is Saturday, November 5th. For more information, call 917-721-8505. That is 917-721-8505. That is Morant Bay High School. The OID, the Organization for International Development, they're coming back stronger and better with their 2022 Christmas Gala Saturday, December 3rd inside the Green Tree Country Club. Music by my brother, DJ Roy and Road International. You don't want to miss it. And then we have Taste Bits of Jamaica. This one is Saturday, October 15th at the Brooklyn Commons. Good morning, Kim. How is everything going on with you? And then, finally, the Caribbean Medical Mission. They're having their grand event. And again, this one is on November 5th, 2022. The question is being asked on why are we so rebellious as Africans? Why are we so rebellious? The slave, the enslaved that went to Jamaica. Well, take a listen to this piece that I found for you.
As a person of African descent, we must really analyze the history of the Atlantic slave trade, because at times, popular narratives overshadow proper historical perspectives. That being said, all throughout the history of enslavement, Africans from various ethnic backgrounds resisted, some more successful than others. The ultimate success, of course, being the Haitian Revolution. But today, I wanted to touch on one African ethnic group that received such a reputation for being so rebellious that certain enslavers didn't even want to acquire them. As mentioned before, Africans of various ethnic backgrounds resisted slavery in different ways. Nearly all ethnic groups were forcefully taken across the Atlantic had some history of resistance. However, some African ethnic groups had more success, and I don't necessarily mean success in terms of actually achieving their principal goals, but success in terms of making enslavers think twice about acquiring them, simply because of the trouble they would have to go through. The most salient among these ethnic groups were the Akan-speaking peoples. Ironically, Africans from the Gold Coast, a region in which many Akan live, were in demand on the island of Jamaica. They were deemed good workers, but the caveat to that was that they were also more likely to kill their enslavers. When it came to the enslaved Akan people in Jamaica, their military training and their courage led them to resist oppression. They rebelled more frequently than any other ethnic group. Edward Long, a planter historian, described how 33 of them, mostly new arrivals, murdered or wounded 19 white men in an hour. The Jamaica Assembly, assessing the causes of the mid-18th century revolts, declared, all these disturbances have been planned and conducted by the Coromanti Negroes. Modern writers confirm that Akan's slaves did indeed organize the serious rebellions of the 17th and 18th centuries. Knowing their reputation, planters of the Eastern Caribbean avoided buying Akan slaves. This history is pretty significant because of the hell brought upon by enslaved Akan people in particular. Entire regions of the Caribbean refused to even acquire them. Despite this, British slavers in particular preferred enslaved Africans from the Gold Coast. Perhaps one of the other reasons why Jamaica continued to acquire enslaved Akan people was because of the options enslavers had. Apparently, enslavers on smaller islands were more selective in their acquisition of enslaved Africans, as larger islands such as Jamaica could only obtain enslaved people in sufficient numbers if they acquired any African brought to their shores. Thus, they were left to deal with the Akan problem. So, this history begs the question, why were the Akan so much more prone to rebellion and seemingly more successful at it, creating entire maroon settlements, particularly in Jamaica? Well, it's because many of the Akan men had active military experience in Africa. African groups other than Angolans also gained a reputation for military prowess. In the Caribbean, many so-called Coromantis, Akan-speaking people from the Gold Coast, had military experience, which may well account for the familiarity with guns and even cannon that they showed in late 17th century Jamaican rebellions. One governor of Barbados described the enslaved Akan men as warlike, and a connection was drawn between the leaders of the Akan state of Akwamu, captured in war between 1730 and 1732, and the slave rebellion of 1733 in the Danish West Indies. So as alluded to in the quote earlier, how did the Akan people have experience with guns in Africa? Well, in the 17th century, Akan states such as Akwamu and Denkyera gained access to updated firearms, particularly the new flintlocks. This helped to transform Akan warfare. They began to form their own formations and employ entire units of musketeers. Akwamu was the first Akan state to adopt firearms, and its rulers cultivated an army made up of a core of semi-professional gunmen and a large number of conscripts. So around a century earlier, many Akan people not only had introductory knowledge of firearms, but they were building semi-professional armies around it. Thus, they were well aware of traditional African warfare and more modern military tactics. This clearly served them well in the forest areas of the Caribbean, where they likely used both tactics of warfare to establish maroon settlements. In short, many slaves had served in African armies prior to their enslavement, and as ex-soldiers and veterans of African wars, they probably needed little encouragement to serve again. Some of the tactics of maroons and other rebellious slaves, small bands, skirmishing, close combat, may owe something to homeland experiences. Aside from the independent maroon settlements in Jamaica spearheaded by the Akan-speaking Africans, one of the biggest rebellions on the island of Jamaica, called Tacky's Rebellion, was yet again initiated by the Akan.
A taste of why we are so rebellious, ladies and gentlemen, where we directly came from and what we did. We're at that moment, ladies and gentlemen, where we're going to have to wrap and make room for the next presentation, which is going to be the Wake Up Radio team. The jam comes in at 1. At 6 p.m., it's going to be Link Up, and at 8 p.m., it's going to be Soundchat Radio. Groovin' Radio was executively produced by Clement Hume and Christopher Roberts. Groovin' Radio was hosted by Rasclem. Contributing to our presentation this Saturday morning, we kicked off our programming this October 1st with the music of the one and only Mr. Mark Myrie, a.k.a. Buju Banton. In our community engagement segment, we were joined by the Lenox Road Baptist Church celebrating 150 years. Senior Pastor Sir Patrick Kirk, Sir Patrick Cohall. He joined us this morning. We got news courtesy of the Jamaica with the Jamaica Gleaner, Jamaica Now with Mr. Javon Johnson. Anthony Turner joined us with Entertainment Report. And yes, on Mic Check, we had the privilege of talking to one of the best breast surgeons out of the state of Connecticut, Dr. Kamenia Lawrence. She joined us as we kicked off our Grooving Radio breast cancer awareness presentation. Waiting on the other side of the 11:30 hour, it is going to be the Wake Up Radio team. I will join you at 6 p.m. tomorrow evening.